We'll call today's meeting to order. And we have a quorum, so if Representative Lothar, would you move the minutes for us?
I move minutes.
Of the February 20th meeting. All in favor of those? Well, any discussion? Okay, all in favor say aye.
Aye.
All opposed? The minutes are adopted. All right. Representative Sertich. And Representative Sertich, I will move House File 633 that it be recommended to pass and re-refer to the Commerce Committee.
Thank you, Mr. Chair.
Representative Sertich.
Thank you, Mr. Chair and members. I'm before you today with House File 633, which came to me originally as a concern from some constituents of mine. And I'll tell you a bit about the story. I received a phone call from a constituent in Chisholm and told me a story about their family's son. He was born in Hibbing, and there were some complications, and it had to be flown from Hibbing to Duluth. And because of this, was not able to be tested for functional congenital malformation. Had since after that found out that their child potentially did have this. But because he was not tested in Hibbing right after he was born, the insurance company would not provide for the hearing aids that this young man needed for his life. And so they said, is there something we can do about that? And I said, sure. So I instructed them to work with the Attorney General's office and their insurance company to work out the details on this. And this family then said it was good that we were able to figure out how to make this work for our case, but we still want you to do something for all the other children or families out there that may be have the same and similar instance. And so I don't bring up their names. I'm not going to get into particulars of their story because it's not as important as the overall idea that we already have in statute, and you can see in the bill we're amending the statute, that we do provide, and health care plans must cover hearing aids for individuals under 18 years of age for this particular condition. Though in the instance of my constituent, there was no way of knowing if that condition, they had that condition or not, and now they have to go through the process of trying to prove this. My feeling is this is an important issue, and I don't think we should delineate between those children who suffer from this very particular condition or potentially have hearing loss when they're children in any other way, shape, or form. So that is the main reason why I bring the bill before you today, and I have some folks here to testify briefly, if the chair would allow.
That would be terrific. Thanks. And please just identify yourself for the record.
Thank you very much, Mr. Chairman and members of the committee. My name is Peggy Nelson. I'm a professor of audiology at the University of Minnesota.
Go ahead.
Thank you. Thank you very much for inviting me today, and thank you, Representative Sertich, for introducing this important piece of legislation. 4 years ago, the legislature determined that it was good public policy for insurance companies to cover hearing aids for babies and children with hearing loss when it was due to this congenital malformation of the ear. And that language came from old statutes. And we knew then, and we know now, that there are more children and babies with hearing loss than just that limited definition. But it was difficult to get that through at the time. And so we hope to return so that all children with hearing loss could be included in this mandate, whether they were tested at birth or whether the hearing loss occurred shortly after birth. In Minnesota, children with congenital hearing loss then are eligible for financial support for their much-needed hearing aids, but there are a significant proportion of children with hearing loss that are not congenital. We estimate about 20% of the children with hearing loss, in those cases, it is not congenital. It's sometimes chickenpox, measles, rubella, mumps, diseases such as this. CMV, a disease that was on the front page of the Star Tribune today, if you noticed that, that it can cause hearing loss shortly after birth, all of those things, as well as ototoxic medications and head trauma and noise and other things. And that permanent hearing loss is a condition that, when left untreated, results in serious permanent delays in language acquisition, in learning, cognitive development. We believe that all children with hearing loss then should be eligible and have access to hearing aids to prevent further reductions in this speech and language ability. I brought you a little spelling test. If you would take 1 minute to take this spelling test for me.
Number one, fill. Number two, cat. Number three, fun.
Oops. Can't hear that, can you?
Number one, filled.
So that's the filling test that's been designed to
eliminate
hearing loss in the first
catch.
And now through a hearing aid.
Number three, fun.
So you can imagine going through school in the first condition, not being able to understand the words clearly, and then in the second condition where everyone would have access to amplification. We want to be able to provide that for all children. So consider the experience of learning that your child has a permanent hearing loss. The good news is that treatment is available in the form of hearing aids. If it were something that was eligible for surgery, your insurance would pay for the surgery. If it was eligible for medication, your insurance would pay for the medication. But unfortunately, health insurance won't pay for hearing aids unless you're lucky enough to be a state employee, or you qualify for medical assistance, or if your child has this congenital malformation of the ear. So this doesn't seem like responsible or fair health policy. The Joint Committee on Infant Hearing, the American Academy of Pediatrics and Audiology support this kind of legislation where all health plans would pay for hearing aids for children when they are the appropriate significant treatment for significant hearing loss, whether the hearing loss is congenital or acquired, whether the family had the test immediately after birth. It makes sense medically. It seems the right thing to do. We know that this mandate will only cover close to 30% of the fully insured plans in the state, and the rest are covered by publicly funded insurance, self-insured plan. This year, about 2,300 kids, birth through 21, would be enrolled in special ed. We estimate that this legislation would increase then about 20% additional children would be covered under this new legislation, which would mean maybe 400 kids every 3 years would be then eligible for hearing aids. So the impact on the insurance industry would not be terribly great. The impact, on the other hand, will be great on those kids with hearing loss who don't get hearing aids currently because their families can't afford the cost. Thank you very much.
Mr. Chair, back when this bill was passed a few years ago, there were some rock stars who testified in front of that committee. Brought them back for more, if you have just a few more moments to bring a family up who's seen some success.
Thank you. Welcome.
Thank you, Chair and committee members. My name is Diane Wanchoba, and I am Eric and Cameron's mom. My third-grade twin boys have a moderate to severe hearing loss due to a congenital malformation. Today we are asking you to pass House File 633. 4 years ago, we asked you to pass a bill which would require insurance companies to cover hearing aids for children born with a hearing loss. Thankfully, that bill passed into law. Since that time, I have had dozens of families personally thank me for my work in advocating for my boys. I tell them to thank their representatives and senators because our great state takes care of Minnesota's children. Having twins with a hearing loss has its advantages. In this context, the advantage is that they have an identical hearing loss in all 4 ears. So even though they weren't diagnosed until they were 2.5 years old, the doctors could confidently conclude that their hearing loss is due to their genetic makeup and was present at birth. However, there are families who have children with hearing impairment who cannot be definitively determined when their hearing impairment occurred, whether it's post or pre-birth. Therefore, the law we passed 4 years ago may not apply to them. The legislature passed hearing aid coverage 4 years ago because it was the most cost-effective solution to treating our hearing-impaired children. The cost-effectiveness applies to children with acquired hearing loss or pre-birth hearing impairment. Eric and Cameron are now in third grade. In the past 7 years, they have had 19 teachers and paraprofessionals. 16 of them were during preschool and kindergarten. Once diagnosed and treated with their hearing loss, the boys had to go through lots of therapy. Initially, they were testing at a one-year-old IQ level when they were 2.5 years old. So they were a year and a half behind when they were 2.5. After 4 years of educational therapy, they were mainstreamed into their neighborhood school and testing at the top of their class, and in some areas, they test in the 90th percentile on national tests. Our school district asked our permission to bill our insurance company for all their therapeutic services. In addition, while the boys were in preschool and kindergarten, they were receiving speech therapy from a private firm twice a week during the summer. Our insurance company paid for these services as well. Had our boys been diagnosed and treated with digital hearing aids at birth, at the onset of their hearing impairments, their therapies would have been greatly reduced or eliminated altogether. In my opinion, all the therapy they went through would not have been successful without the initial intervention of their hearing aids. For our boys, their current hearing aids cost $2,000 per year. Initially, we purchased $800 analog hearing aids, and after 2 years, we realized they were not working. Once we made the decision to implement the digital, more costly hearing aids, we saw great improvements in their therapy. Minnesota does take care of its children. I certainly don't question that. We could spend an estimated $30,000 to $200,000 on their K-12 education, according to a 1999 Johns Hopkins University study, which is being billed to our taxpayers and our insurance companies. Or we can identify and treat a hearing loss at the onset of the hearing impairment and minimize the educational costs, as well as allow the child to reach their full potential to serve Minnesota. Thank you very much.
Thank you. Any questions, members? Okay. Thank you very much.
Thank you.
Mr. Chair, that means I'm done with my testimony.
Okay. Thank you. Why don't we hear the rest of the testifiers, and then we can come back for questions, if that's okay. So, Mr. Stahlberger.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman, members. Phil Stahlberger with Blue Cross Blue Shield in Minnesota. I have my three closest friends with me behind me. I'm four, sorry. Just to touch on a couple of things from a kind of a global healthcare perspective, we did not oppose this mandate back in 2002, I believe it was, when the previous testifier said this bill was introduced originally. We don't necessarily agree with the merits of this bill either. We're simply here to remind the committee that the fully insured market is shrinking. I have a handout that I've passed out that, as you can see by the pie chart, Minnesota has less than 30% of the market that is actually regulated by state law. So, and I think the previous testifier did say that as well. So the vast majority of the market has moved to becoming self-insured, thereby being exempt from state laws, taxes, mandates, regulations, etc. While the cost of this mandate will be minimal, will be spread out across the rest of the insured market, we do continue to hear from small businesses, individuals, that any increase, whether it be small or large, is becoming greater and greater difficulty in affording those premiums. Minnesota has the most number of mandates in the country. You may have heard that we do have 62 mandates, and I think we have about 10 more introduced this session, this being one of them. If you recall back in 2003, the legislature actually created a mandate review process in state law under 62J.26. The intent of this law was to review any new proposed mandates, be reviewed and discussed with the Commerce Department and other professionals to look at the cost efficiency of the mandate. To the best of my knowledge, I don't know if that review process has actually been utilized since 2002, but nonetheless, it still is on the books. With that, Mr. Chairman and members, I'd be happy to answer questions or defer to my friends for other comments or questions as well. Thank you.
Any questions, members? Representative Loffler.
Mr. Chair, Mr. Stahlberger, do we have any information about, I understand that we can only regulate those that aren't self-insured. But do we have any evidence from your experience when you're dealing with self-insured companies that they do tend to pick up many of those mandates that they're exempt from just because they think it's good policy or supportive of the families they're insured?
Mr. Stolberger.
Mr. Chairman, Representative Loeffler. Self-insurers, depending on their size, will pick and choose their benefit level, whether that be the benefit level from a cost perspective or benefit level from a cost-sharing perspective or mandate benefits. It's kind of all over the board.
Any additional questions, members? On this, do you know on the 62J.26, has that been funded?
Mr. Chairman, members, if I remember correctly, I don't know if there's any funding required. The sources of funding are apparently up to the Commissioner of Commerce to use whatever funds necessary.
Okay. Any further questions, members of this? Excuse me? Representative Brock.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. And Mr. Stolberger, has any of the mandates or proposed mandates actually gone through that system? Or was it put into place and it's been just sitting there nicely on the shelf?
Mr. Chairman, Phil Griffin, representing Preferred One. Representative Brock, to your question, no, that process has not been used. The Commerce Department has testified in the past. I haven't checked with them this year. That they can use this process without additional cost, so it could be used with the legislature to see it fit to do so, and we would recommend that as a good idea.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. I think this is a very good discussion. Hopefully, if this bill is passed, we'll be going to the Commerce Committee to discuss this issue. I just strongly believe in the power of the legislative body over the administration and bureaucracy. I believe in our ability better to make these public policy decisions than leaving it alone to the Department of Commerce.
Mr. Chairman, Phil Griffin, I know we're not in a debate society, but if I could just respond to Representative Loeffler's question. There's no question that a lot of large self-insurers use the mandated benefits that the state has established in statute for insured plans to set up their systems, but they almost always exempt themselves from a number of the mandates, including the lifetime maximum, of which health plans in the state have no lifetime maximum. You'll see most of them with $1 million lifetime cap. They also are exempt from all of the taxes, and those are fairly substantial in our marketplace. So we would just point that out to the committee. Yes, they do work with a lot of the mandates. They aren't the huge source of cost, but they do add up. And as we said, with 9 of them introduced this session, the cost would be substantial were all of them to pass.
And Mr. Griffin or Mr. Stolberger, or I guess it's Mr. Stolberger, the cost of this particular mandate you said would be minimal. Do you have any more detail? In addition to that?
Yes, Mr. Chairman. Just from our quick actuarial analysis and talk to our medical directors, I think among all of the insured market, it'd be less than 1%.
Representative Anderson.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Either to the author or to the testifiers, is there any federal funding involved with this issue or this group of kids at all?
Any of the witnesses?
Not that I'm aware of, and I don't believe so.
Mr. Chairman, other than the fact that many children are eligible for the Medicaid program, the Medicaid program can pay for this, I just make the deal sort of that.
I guess I would have one other question. There was some testimony from the other witness that school districts and others actually submit their special education costs and those things to insurance companies. Did I misunderstand that?
Mr. Chairman, Phil Griffin, Preferred One. No, you did not misunderstand that. Health plans regularly pay for the costs of therapies, but not for educational costs. And there's been a debate over the years over what is therapy versus what is education, and we continue to work with the education community on those. But quite correctly, the insurance company is liable if there's therapy going on, and we pay substantial costs of people that are in schools and doing school-based.
I'd like to get your reaction to the question of whether the cost that you pay out on those therapies, whether you've done any analysis of that versus kind of saving on those costs that the last witness testified about. Any reaction from the any of the health plans sitting here?
Mr. Chairman, members, I don't think the health plans would be in a position of saying that we don't think doing early intervention is a bad idea. Quite clearly, if we can treat things early, we look at the newborn screening, which you're going to be seeing a bill in front of you in the not too far distant future, as something that is a very, very good idea. If we can catch these hearing anomalies, if we can catch other things, some of them aren't just issues that relate to quality of lifestyles, but some of these are actually, as you know, Mr. Chairman, from personal experience, life-saving treatments that can be done on infants. And so when we come before you and say, we're looking at this mandate, we aren't opposed to it, we are raising the questions of what the costs are, we're quite sincere in that approach. We can spend all the money that you want in health care. We will spend whatever you ask us to put in statute. The question is, how much can we afford? And that's the issue that we're receiving pushback on, as you are on a daily basis from constituents who are saying, I can no longer afford.
I appreciate that. Thank you. Representative Norton.
Chair Thiessen, committee members and testifiers, I'm having to go back ways. For years I worked in the area of early intervention, and for 3 years worked with birth to three special needs students. And so I'm recalling that a particular area of trouble that we had was when we would find a young child diagnosed with a hearing impairment and they did not qualify for TEPRA. That's a very hard, the hearing impairment area is a very hard area for families to qualify for TEPRA. So there weren't as many children that I was able to help receive hearing aids, save going through private health insurance for many of the families that I dealt with. And I just want to refer to something. I think the testifiers have been very eloquent in and have dealt with many of the things that I would have talked to, and I won't because I don't want to repeat them. But I do think it's worth noting, with the early intervention, which you had just alluded to, the cost savings on the speech therapy and special education costs that both health insurance and schools have to provide, I'm not saying this correctly, but those can be waylaid by providing and making certain that our very young children get hearing aids early, particularly these new digital hearing aids. And so I'm wondering if you can tell me, as you've looked at perhaps minimal costs, are you considering the cost savings that you may have when you don't have to provide speech therapies and some of those other costs to these children?
Mr. Chairman, Representative Norton, absolutely, your point is right on. I wish that we could recapture some of the savings from the educational institutions. Of course, we can't. Clearly, there would be savings that are there. But our point would be that we hope that the review process that was outlined in 62J could be used to assess those things before we come before this committee and try and make those decisions.
Any other questions by the members? Thank you.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman.
Patty Morelli, I skipped over. I'm sorry. She wasn't. Okay. Did you want to testify, Ms.? Okay. Then Ms. Sexton.
I think I forgot to bring my entourage. I don't know. Mr. Chair, thank you. My name is Erin Sexton, and I'm with the Minnesota Chamber of Commerce. And I kind of like just to say ditto to a lot of what the testifiers before you said. I represent 2,400 members around the state, 80% of which have fewer than 100 employees. So I think I do bring a little bit of a perspective, because a lot of these employers are going to be hit with additional costs of these mandates. We, as I know you all, are concerned about the rising cost of health care. It's the number one issue facing my members, and as costs continue to rise, it's becoming more and more difficult for employers to continue to offer health benefits to their employees. As you heard, Minnesota does currently have 62 mandates. It is the highest number in the country, and these mandates only apply to the fully insured market, which is mainly, you know, small and medium businesses who have not had the ability to self-insure. So we are looking at one very small slice of the market along with our public programs. And so I understand that the legislation before you is only an expansion of a current mandate, but the cost of this expansion is not just absorbed by health insurance companies. It is passed on to ratepayers through it is passed on to people who purchase health insurance through increased premiums in the fully insured market. So I think it does just It's good for us to keep in mind that this isn't something the insurance companies just absorb. This is something that people pay for. And this is not only, not only is a small portion of the market shouldered with a high number of mandates, but they're also assessed for the MSHA assessment, and also pay a premium tax. And those, once again, only fall on this one small segment of the market. All these additional costs are falling on those who arguably have the least ability to absorb these growing costs. There are a number of, and really this is why I wanted to come before you as much as anything, because there are a number of additional mandates that you're going to be hearing this session. You've already heard a few. And as you make decisions on whether to add to the current 62, I would just urge you to consider the cumulative effect of these. And I understand and doubt the cost of this one, and you heard from Blue Cross Blue Shield that the cost of this one is not substantial. But as you look at the 5, 6, 7, 8, 9, 10 of these that you may hear throughout the session, I mean, I think we need to think of these in a more cumulative effect on what this does to our health insurance premiums. Because, it is nice to have a great comprehensive benefit package, but it doesn't do much good if people are unable to afford to give that to their employees. So I would urge you to consider evaluating these and other proposed mandates under the 62J.26. So you and then those employers and individuals who pay these premiums can understand the implications of these mandates that you're looking at. And actually, I did, if there's a page, bring to the committee copies of this section of statute if you'd want to take a look at it. It hasn't been used before, but I do think we need to think about the implications of this and the broader impact instead of just looking at these one by one. And that's what I would urge you to do.
Any questions, members? Representative Bunn.
Thank you, Chair Keith. And this is not necessarily for either the two people at the desk up there right now, but a general question that possibly the chair or somebody else in the room might be able to answer for me. If an individual is born without a limb, a leg, arm, hand, do most health insurance in the private markets, so the market we're describing here, currently cover the cost of providing those prosthetic arms and limbs as long as those individuals are covered under those plans? Any of our health insurers in the room, can they answer the question? Thank you.
Go ahead.
Jeanette Coleman with Medica, and yes, we do actually cover prosthetic services. They are covered benefits of the plan.
And just to follow up, and generally that's fairly true through the industry with typical family plans that
there are some criteria around them, and there's some limitations in coverage, but I think that would be pretty standard.
And just to follow up with one thing further, since we're talking today about specifically the hearing loss, non-congenital, that occurs later, if someone loses a limb or some other functioning like that because of an accident at some point, is that covered through some sort of accident type insurance, or is it also the prosthetic then gets covered through medical insurance?
Mr. Chair, Representative Bunn, yes, I mean, it would depend on how the accident occurred, mm-hmm. but if it wasn't an auto accident or covered under workers' comp or something like that, then it would be something that would be adjusted to health insurance,
okay.
Again, with the limitations and the parameters, but generally, yes.
Thank you. And generally, the comment part of that, then, is I just, while I'm very sensitive to the issue of the number of mandates, very, very sensitive to it, because one of the reasons I came here was to work on healthcare cost issues. I also am sensitive to the issue of fairness across our insurance system, and that it seems to me that what we're looking at today is quite analogous to the issue I raised about, loss of cost from birth or after birth for children, not having part of an arm or leg or something like that, that affects their functioning. And so I would tend to think, more supportively of this issue because of that fairness across the market and what we offer.
Ms. Sexton.
And Mr. Chair and Representative Bunn, I appreciate mm-hmm. the fairness aspect. And I guess the point I would like to make is whether it's a fairness aspect or not, is somebody is going to pay for this.
Mm-hmm.
And that is a very small slice of the market. And I think that's just the point I would want to make. It's not to say hearing aids are bad. It's it's to say in the end somebody is going to pay for it. And it's unfortunately the way it falls disproportionately on those who tend to have the least ability to absorb those costs.
Representative Surge.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. And just to amplify this discussion a little bit, we I guess I'm probably the first mandate in front of this committee, it sounds like, because from the third, they're just still venting.
I think it's...
Okay. Well, be that as it may, I think you do need to take it on a case-by-case basis. I think it's very important. Mandate has tended to become an evil word around here, or said with a snarl on some individuals' faces, not all. But when you're talking about screening for breast cancer and other issues, mandates are a good thing in some instances, and I believe this is one of them as well when you talk about fairness. And when you talk about cost, I mean, I can understand that you just said broken record. I mean, that is the line that you want to use if you want, you know. But when we talk about costs, let's remember back to previous testifiers, the cost of therapy that then is passed on through the healthcare system. When you're preventative, generally most of the time, there's less cost involved, and what we're trying to do is be preventative here.
Representative Norton.
I think that partly summarized what I wanted to say, and I would just add to that, I guess I was kind of surprised to see the Chamber here given, at least in my community, the huge support of the Chamber on early intervention, and I see this particular piece, particularly when we're talking about children, as just one other aspect of early intervention, and I would hope that the cost savings due to prolongated therapies and savings in even areas of education would help offset that. But I'm glad to hear that you're not just here about this issue, but you're here about perhaps six or three or eight other mandates, and not just this one. I think this one's worth our vote.
President Broad.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. And, I think most times these mandates come from somebody's personal experience and from some very good places. But, Mr. Chairman, we do have also a process that was put in place to ensure that we don't have to hope we know what the savings are and hope we know what the impacts are, but that would provide us as a legislature a comprehensive look at what are the costs and benefits all in one fell swoop. So I'm wondering, Mr. Chairman, I look at 62J, subdivision 3, and it talks about requests for an evaluation. It states that A, whenever a legislative measure containing a mandated health benefit proposal is introduced as a bill or offered as an amendment to a bill, or is likely to be introduced as a bill or offered as an amendment, a chair of any standing legislative committee that has jurisdiction over the subject matter may request that the commissioner complete an evaluation of this proposal. So, Mr. Chairman, I think that as this bill moves forward, I think it would be very helpful for us as a legislative body, as we're voting on this on the House floor, to have that comprehensive look. And so I would request to you today that you make this request of the commissioner so that we have all the information we need to have about the costs and benefits. We may find that the savings are worth moving forward on this, but I do think for the legislature to make that decision, I would request that you do that today. Thank you, Mr. Chairman.
Thank you. President Bond.
Thank you, Chair Thiessen. Just for clarification, I wanted to ask either Representative Broad or yourself, are we talking about the fiscal? It sounds like you were talking about something beyond a fiscal note here, because a traditional fiscal note would not be able to pick up, you know, savings to school districts or other kinds of savings that have been alluded to. So are we talking about a more comprehensive type of evaluation?
Well, Representative Bunn, I think, in fact, I don't think this bill costs the state anything. So I think it's not a fiscal note. Is that what's contemplated here is not a fiscal note in that sense at all. So it looked at the cost. It looks like a cost-benefit analysis. Mm-hmm. I don't think that the previous chairs of any committees for the last 4 years since this was adopted have engaged in this process. Mm-hmm. But we certainly will take that under advisement and go forward. Representative Emmer.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Has any chair of any committee been requested, like today, to follow this 62J, do you know?
I don't know that. I will take that under advisement, and I just need to look through the legislation.
Mr. Chairman.
Yes.
Thank you. And in regards to your statement about the last 4 years, you know, we all can look backward or we can look forward. I think this is a great opportunity to bring a statute back in play that probably should be in play, should have been in play over the past 4 years and should be in play going forward. So if we're not going to follow the statute, maybe Representative Cervich would look at a repealer. Mr. Chairman, I would appreciate, and I do appreciate your willingness to look at this, and I hope that we do follow this process.
Thank you. And Representative Broad, I think one thing I'd like to look at is the reasons that it hasn't been requested in the past, because it says the chair may. It's a permissive. And I don't know what analysis Representative Bradley, for instance, did when he was considering whether to make these requests. And so I'd like to kind of follow up with him and find that out as well. So any further discussion, members? If no further discussion, we're going to vote on the bill. So I would renew my motion that House File 633. I will look into this. Yes. House File 633 is Ms. Hartwig. I'm sorry.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Members, my name is Beth Hartwig. I represent Minnesota Business Partnership. I have not spoken to the committee on the mandates that have been before you yet, but I happened to be here today and hear the question from Representative Loeffler on the self-insured market and felt that I should probably bring our position to the table on mandates. Well, my members are self-insured, large employers, and are therefore exempted from the mandates that are passed by this legislature onto the small group market. However, with the growing cost of providing coverage, employers are looking for any way that they can slow that growth and for themselves as well as for their employees. When benefit managers start looking at their benefit set to cover and their ability to cover their employees, I suggest that they would probably look at how they can provide coverage for the most number of people, and that might be by changing the benefit set. Now, many of the companies do adopt some of the mandates that are passed by the legislature, on a voluntary basis. But if the question comes down to, am I going to cover more people or am I going to provide this extensive benefit set, I suggest that they probably look at ways that they can cover more people. And this is a luxury that the small group market doesn't have. Mm-hmm. So I just wanted to enter that for the record, that we do oppose not the idea, the specific mandate, but it's the idea of all of the mandates as they're put together as a whole.
Mm-hmm. Thank you. Members, I think we're going to move to a vote so we can get to the next bill. So I renew my motion that House 633 be recommended to pass, and it is going to the Commerce Committee. All in favor of that motion say aye.
Aye.
Aye. All opposed? The motion prevails.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman.
Thank you, Representative Cervich. And thank you to everybody. Representative Lane. And as Representative Lane is coming down, I will move House File 595 be recommended to pass and re-referred to the Finance Committee. Mm-hmm. Representative Lane.
Thank you.
And I believe there's a delete all amendment. But would you like me to move that to put the bill in the order you would like it?
Yes, we have a delete all amendment. HO 595DE1.
Okay, I will move the DE1 amendment, members, to get the bill in the form the author would like it. All in favor of that motion, say aye.
Aye.
All opposed? The motion is adopted. Representative Lane, go ahead.
Okay, and then I would like one oral amendment to change wording, two small wording changes. If you look on 2.24, we'll change we will revert to the original language in the statute on 2.24. So we'll say must include a public health nursing assessment by a public health nurse.
Okay, members, do you understand that? I'll make that motion. Do members under...
One more little piece.
Oh, sure.
And on line 3.11, the change possible to available, so when available, and then programs that receive funds must offer, and the comma, refer to or connect with a center-based group. So comma, refer to or connect with.
Okay. Members, I will repeat the amendment and move the amendment. On line 2.24, and this is on the delete all amendment that we're now amending, which is the bill now. But line 2.24, it would simply revert the language to the current statute. So we would eliminate the striking of public health, nursing, take out comprehensive, and take out of the family. So we're back to the original language. And on line 3.11, replace possible with available, and after the word offer, add, comma, refer to or connect with. Is that right?
That's right.
Okay. All in favor of that amendment, say aye.
Aye.
All opposed? Okay. Representative Lane.
Okay, some brief comments. That this bill updates the language of Minnesota Statute 145A.17 to reflect current practice. And the proposed new language emphasizes a multidisciplinary approach to home visiting and focuses on coordination between the systems that exist to assist families of young children. And it also clarifies the duties of the State Health Department, including providing training, technical assistance, and outcome measurement. And then lastly, the bill appropriates funding for the statewide family home visiting system. And this appropriation actually reserves some funding for the State Health Department to do these activities such as the training. I would emphasize that this whole family home visiting program is voluntary and that it actually serves to empower parents, some of the key points, I think. Just quickly, I would like to refer to some of the things you have in your packet. There's a Minnesota Department of Health form here on family home visiting. Emphasize that family home visiting has been around 100 years, and some comment that 43% of all births could benefit from some form of home visiting. Also, the history is that in 2001, $11 million was given to this program through TANF monies, and then in 2003 it was cut. There's $4 million now. We would seek to have at least the cuts restored, but this appropriation piece is blank because we want to discuss it with the Department of Health on what the current population of need is. I would also point on the side of that page to some of the effects, the effects of saving money that programs like this provide. There are fewer incidents of child abuse and neglect and all the costs that are associated with that. There are fewer outside placements where the children are placed outside the home and all the costs associated with that, fewer emergency health services, costs associated with that, and there's actually fewer regressed, et cetera, that are, and the costs associated with that. I would just point out in this other one on the Metro Alliance for Healthy Families, fourth paragraph down, at the end of the paragraph, there's a quote that says, "No other single intervention has the promise that home visitation has." So personally, my concern has been for healthy brain development. I'm 3 years into a PhD program in psychology and put that on leave to come here. So I'm very aware of the developmental sequence of the brain growth, and in some cases it happens because families know how to support it just naturally through safety and nurturing care and bonding and interactive activities, and in some cases it does not happen fully. And this is a very much concern to me with my focus on education because I think personally there's a direct correlation to achievement gap in education. That starts here, and I would love to see it stopped, the cycle of lack stopped here. We have some testifiers here, and we'd like to start here with Terry Rose.
All right, Ms. Rose, please identify for your Dr. Rose, I guess, huh? Please identify yourself for the record, if you would. Representative Gottwald, did you have a...
No.
Okay. All right.
Go ahead. I'm Terry Rose. I'm the president and founder of Baby Safe, the Place to Grow, which is an early care and education center in the Phillips neighborhood serving primarily American Indian families. And maybe mostly important to you, I provide training and consultation across the state of Minnesota and nationally and internationally on issues of early childhood mental health. And I'm involved in training most of our mental health providers across the state so we have a better understanding of really what is good, solid, early childhood social and emotional development. And what I'd like to do is, in one way, to tell you what I, my goal for all very young children, as we look across in terms of really having competent citizens, and it's that we have children that are able to form relationships, able to regulate their emotions, and able to learn and explore the environment. And those
can I just interrupt? Just for, yes. I'm sorry to do this.
That's okay.
I think just in, we're going to try to do about till about quarter after for the I think there's about three witnesses.
Okay.
And then, so we have an equal amount of time on this issue.
Yeah,
thanks.
You got it, sure. And so what I wanted to do is to just point out to you, what is the connection between brain development and home visiting? How do you get the two connected? And really, how do we bring the research forward that really helps us make that connection? One of our best bets right now in looking at how does the brain form, we know that prenatally, it's really genetically driven. And once that baby's born, it's experience that informs the brain. Chuck Nelson and Charlie Zina went to Romania and studied the brain development of children in those orphanages, which are under, in terms of the experience they're receiving, we have aberrant caregiving and economic impoverishment. If you look at that, is probably our worst case scenario. And what they found by looking at really the neuroimaging of what was happening is children under those conditions underpower their brain. That is, the synapses stop forming, the brain stops developing in the way that we would typically expect. Now, that's in Romania under the worst conditions, but here in Minnesota, we have a child in southern Minnesota who sits in a walker all the day because his mother is so depressed that she cannot get off the couch. And whether he's changed or fed has nothing to do with the cues and signals he's given. Or a very young baby up in northern Minnesota who's both hearing impaired and sight impaired, and mom puts her in a crib and props the bottle to feed her because why would it matter? No, she can't hear or see anyway. Home visiting has the opportunity to come in and support parents in establishing these relationships with their children under conditions that make it less likely for the parent to provide typical experiences. And what are those conditions? They're conditions of poverty, they're conditions of homelessness, of domestic violence, of drug use, of limited cognitive understanding. Those are the kind of targeting that we need to do to really help support parents so they know how to provide this nurturing environment that helps their child really succeed. The last example I want to give you is around emotional regulation. We're all really worried about those kids getting kicked out of kindergarten or out of preschool. A very interesting study was done in which we looked at typical stressful situations for young children, going to the doctor or seeing a clown. And when you're 12 months or you're 2 years old, those are two things that make you really worried. And what do we see in those kids is they all look pretty frightened. When we look biologically, though, we see that their biological experience is different based on the kind of relationship they have with their parents. Children that have secure attachments with their parents biologically don't react to those scary situations. Children who cannot count on their parent being there, that is, they have a relationship in which being responsive and consistent has not been part of their experience, their own primitive stress response system, the cortisol, which is our measurement of stress, kicks in. So a 12-month-old or a 2-year-old's own body is trying to take care of a stressful situation because they've learned they can't count on them, the adults around them. Home visiting makes that partnership with parents that allows them to make the partnership with their baby that creates that sense of security and really fosters the child's ability to form relationships, regulate their emotions, and learn and explore in their environment. Thank you.
Any questions, members? Okay, thank you very much. Mr. Fulton? Is Mr. Fulton here?
I can.
Okay, go ahead. Please identify yourself for the record. Thanks.
Okay. Mr. Chairman, members of the committee, my name is Ann Byrie, and I am the Community Health Services Director for Meeker, McLeod, and Sibley Counties. The local Public Health Association of Minnesota, the Association of Minnesota Counties, and the Minnesota Intercounty Association strongly support this bill. Family home visiting is a key local government responsibility, and community health boards have a long history of providing family home visiting in their communities. This bill would leverage current resources to expand and improve home visiting services across the state. Some things that community health boards bring to family home visiting include things such as we already have programs where we connect with high-risk families, such as WIC, child and teen checkups, school nursing. Public health nurses are trusted resources to many families, and we have many linkages with community resources that families need. Local health departments report that with additional funding, they would be able to serve more families and provide more services to their current clients. Across the state, local health departments report that they have anywhere from 20 to 100% more need than they have resources. And many local health departments do very little outreach right now because they don't have the resources to provide the services to serve more families. What do public health nurses do in home visiting? They provide an assessment based on population-based health practice. They look for risk factors that they know are in the community, and they assess the family for health and safety and look at family systems. Some of the things that they assess are the health history of the mother and child, barriers to medical care, use of medical care resources, current health conditions, use of medications, immunization records, the need for family planning services, assessment of child growth and development, looking at the family system and cultural norms, nutritional needs of the infant and child feeding practices, and home and child-based safety. And this would include use of car seats, and a number of other things. They also do an environmental assessment to look whether there's a safe water supply, the presence of lead-based paint, and they look at neighborhood safety. Their focus is primary prevention, focused on promoting and protecting good health status, knowing that this is far more effective than remediation once problems have occurred. We use a strength-based approach, building on families' assets and promoting self-sufficiency. I think with that, I'll entertain any questions. Otherwise,
any questions, members?
Yes.
Representative Emmer.
Thank you very much. Ma'am, Mr. Chair, ma'am, how many public health nurses do we have throughout the state of Minnesota?
I don't know that I can answer that question.
Chair?
Representative Emmer.
You testified that all these different things that home health nurses do throughout the state. I'm wondering where you got your figure that there's a 20% to 100% more need.
That was done through a survey of a local health departments.
Mr. Chair? Thank you. Local health departments across the state of Minnesota or located in the metro area?
Across the state.
Thank you, ma'am.
Would you address your question through the chair, and then I'll...
Oh, okay.
Thank you.
Madam Chair, thank you. The survey was done when?
Madam Chair, Representative, within the last couple of weeks.
And lastly, Madam Chair, the testifier has testified that this would expand and improve, but what we heard at the outset, and I know you were here, is that I thought what we were doing today is we're addressing House File 595, the delete all, and all it's doing is putting in, according to Representative Lane, it's just codifying current practice. Apparently that's not the case.
Madam Chair, Representative, I defer to...
Representative Lane, I actually think it may be useful to maybe do a little bit of... explain what changed in the delete all from the law itself. Is that from the bill as introduced?
We took out the original bill the part having to do with newborn visiting, which was an extra piece that wasn't in statute at this time, and we took that out in order to focus the resources on the home visiting, which has been As she indicated, the need is much greater than we're able to satisfy at this time because of the cuts that have been made to that program. So we're focusing resources on the home visiting piece, having deleted the newborn visiting piece. And so, yes, the needs are great, much greater than are able to serve at this time.
Representative Emmer, follow-up.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Representative, you're talking about cuts that were made, apparently. Now, are we expanding home visiting, or are we just codifying current practice?
Representative, I think there's two pieces. I mean, there's two things that could be going on. Are we changing the practices, or are we just putting more money in to do what is currently in law? Would that get at your question, Representative Emmer?
That'll work. Okay.
I think what we say is that the statute is being updated to current practices, which is making it more interdisciplinary and more structured, you may say, in terms of making sure that the programs are meeting current research needs to make it a very valid program.
Mr. Chair, I don't know that exactly answered what we were asking, but if I could just expand it, because the problem I'm having is we're talking about trying to take a program that so far all I've heard is testimony about home visiting to try and help families and their children, but unless I don't understand, it's somewhere in law. I'm looking at line 2.13 on page 2, systematic outreach to families prenatally or at birth. I thought we were talking about home visits to help families and their children, and this suggests that this is before we even have a family.
Representative Lane?
I think that we...
Was that a question?
Yeah.
Okay, yeah. Did I?
Mr. Chair, Representative, I think that we might agree that when a person is close to delivery, that is, I would consider that a family situation. I don't think I would consider it only a family at the time of birth. There's needs for that situation and the health of the mother and the baby early. So it is to make sure that the pregnancy outcomes are healthy and good, and so you need to be there to make sure that the prenatal care is there, and that drugs are not there, that abuse is not there, that nutrition is there, so that the outcomes from the pregnancy will be good.
I'll get more later. Thank you.
Okay, Representative Gatwell.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Representative Lane, for our edification, describe exactly what we're talking about then. What kind of visits are we... I'm thinking of my five kids and the births that we went through with them and somebody coming and giving me a visit that I don't want. Tell me how... This does sound like an expansion. Clearly you're wanting to do more of this to more people on a more regular basis, more uniformly, all over the state. And one thing I haven't heard in testimony so far, and maybe we will hear it, is parents or potential parents saying we need this. I'm describe for me, if you will, how this is going to work with somebody about to have a child. Walk me through it.
As I said early on, many people, families, parents know how to do this, provide it naturally, interact with the child, with providing the safety, the nutrition, the care, the interaction, the language development, just naturally. But there are many families, many young mothers who do not know how to do this. They literally do not know how. I have seen it in some of the experiences I've had. They are even holding the child in ways that young infants should not even be held because they don't have the ability to hold their head up yet. They just simply don't know the development of the child. And then in some of the situations of poverty, they don't know where they're going to get diapers. They don't know where they're going to get formula. They don't know where they're going to sleep that night. they have situations of abuse that may impact them, and as we've seen in the news articles lately, may impact the child. There's great need out there, and it's increasing. As far as appreciating the program, I do have something from a 1999 survey by Deborah Darrell, where they did some questioning about this and other things, and 82% of the parents who received home visitation services when their child were young viewed this assistance as useful in learning how to care for their child. 82%.
Mr. Chair. And Representative Gowdy, and just, well, go ahead.
Thank you. Representative Lane, that helped a little bit. It didn't really walk me through how one of these happens, but what you're describing to me is identifying people at risk and going and delivering the services to them. But what I'm reading in the bill is that this expands it to be more uniform across all births in all families. And I guess that's where I'm having a problem with this bill, is that, you know, we all know that there are people in those situations who have a hard time with parenting skills, and we want to get help to them as needed, and we realize that prevents further problems down the road. So I'm not questioning the intent, but I'm questioning what this bill is trying to do to people who may not need that kind of help, who may, in fact, as you said, naturally take care of their children and give them what they need.
I represent that well. There's a couple of things. I mean, I would note that this, you don't have to accept a home visit, and that's in the law currently, and that's not being changed. And I also note that it is giving priority to the lowest income families and families at risk, and focusing in, you know, we have limited resources. I think that's where that money is directed. Representative Lane, do you have?
I would agree. That's what I would have said.
Well, Mr. Chair, if I may then, if we already have these things in place, what are we doing here? Do we already have government programs delivering this, or don't we?
It's severely underfunded, and while we're looking at an appropriation to bring the funding up, we decided to add wording that would make it more in line with current practice.
Mr. Chair, Representative Lane, you have already indicated you're expanding the program, though. So it's not just an additional funding. You're wanting to expand this to additional people, correct?
Representative Godwell, the way I heard it is that we're actually giving more flexibility so that counties can use best practices. So I don't know if it's an expansion or just allowing them to use best practices, because we know some things work and some things don't work, and then there will be some additional funding as well, depending on what the Finance Committee does with it. Representative Bunn.
Chair Thiessen, and Representative Gottwell, I was struggling with some of the same issues in comparing the two versions, the original bill and this one. I'm just going to ask for clarification. I believe that some of the confusion is that in the original bill, there was, in a sense, expansion. It was going to be universal, all families, all children, not just the first one, right, offered to them whether they really were seeking it or not. That's not what's in the amended bill. Am I correct? The amended bill basically is a targeted program still, mostly the low income, under 200% of the poverty level, providing, basically doing what's been going on, but with some updating to current practices in terms of language of how it's functioned. So it does appear to me that there's been a pretty significant change between the original bill and what we're seeing today, and that's maybe leading to some confusion on the part of some of us. But what I'm understanding is what you're currently offering is pretty much kind of the program roughly as we have it now, but updating it to some current practices, which are not an expansion of the program, and it's not all children and enough as well, or whatever. So it's still a fairly targeted situation with that.
Representative Lane?
Mr. Chair, Representative, yes, thank you for that. I had forgotten in my moving through this that you were expecting the original bill and some of the concern over having right at the top there universal newborn visiting, and which, by the way, all along was voluntary. And we were first going to just change that word to make it clear, but decided that we should focus the resources on the home visiting, which is where the research is based, and delete the newborn visiting altogether, and this program still remains voluntary.
And members, there's some more questions, but I think we should go, maybe it would be helpful to get the testifiers to complete their testimony, and then maybe that will answer some of these questions as well.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. My name is Rob Fulton. I'm director of the St. Paul Ramsey County Department of Public Health, a large full-service local public health department here in the metro. We belong to the Local Public Health Association and to the Association of Minnesota Counties, and along with our department, we all support this bill. The Ramsey County Board has set for our department as our top priority, assuring that every child 0 to 6 is safe and nurtured. And to that end, the largest section of our 10 public health sections is our healthy family section. It has a staff of over 70, a budget of $5.6 million a year, and the county board provides $1.9 million of that total budget with local levy. And last year, we served over 2,000 families. Judy is with me today, and she wants to tell you about her experience as a client of our Healthy Family section.
Thanks for coming. Please identify yourself for the tape, and then go ahead.
My name is Judy, and I'm from St. Paul, and I receive the services from a public health nurse that comes to my home and visits. When I was 13, I moved to Minnesota from Florida with my two-month-old son. My nurse is Deb Arrigo, and she's helped me a lot with my son.
No, just take your time.
I am a teen parent. I have two children now, and I am set to graduate this year from high school. And I have plans to move on to college. I want to major in nursing. My public health nurse has helped me a lot, and before I was living with my mom, I had problems. My mom used to use drugs. She was a great help to me. I was referred to speak to Deb from St. Paul Placement Center when I first arrived here from Florida to start school. I had a different public health nurse that later on moved on to older teens, and I was set with Deb at my home visits. She would help me with certain things that I needed for my baby. Like I said, my mom, she used to use drugs and stuff, so she used to help me. We used to talk. She was like the person there that I didn't have in my mom, so she would encourage me to do better. Throughout the way, I started doing bad. I was running away from home. I wasn't taking care of my son. I was having a lot of problems, and I wasn't attending school. That later involved me to get into a TIP program, truancy program, and I started to think about how I wanted to change my life. I wanted to turn everything around. I ended up moving out of my mom's house. Deb helped me with certain to find resources and stuff to help me and my son. I am still in high school. I have two kids now, and they go to the daycare where I go, which is very nice because I have a lot of help there also. I recommend you or any of the members to visit our daycare so you can see what it really does. And the nurses also are involved there too. The things that she helped me with, including home safety, like car seats and all that I didn't have for my kids. She also would take me books for my son. We used to talk about what things to development for him. He's going to be 5. He's going to be going into kindergarten, and she helped me. My mom wasn't really there for us, so I wasn't used to that, reading to him and all that. So I learned that from her. And he's really smart. He's even a translator at school. He speaks Spanish and English, so lets them know what the other little kids are saying. So, and he's really, really smart. She's encouraged me throughout the way. I'm doing great in school. I have A's and B's. I was my school's homecoming queen. And nobody has ever seen a teen parent in school being a homecoming queen. So, yeah. And I also applied for the Power of You, and she helped me with that also. She's helping me do my FAFSA. And I'm looking forward to being someone in life, someone being a mother to my children that my mother wasn't to me. And she's helping me do that.
Thank you.
Thank you, Judy. Just let me add a few last points. Our program is voluntary. Our program has been in existence since the mid-1980s. It's grown every year up through 2003, and when the TANF dollars were pulled away in 2003 to fund other programs, we had a 20% reduction in the number of people that we could serve. Let me give you some of our quick evaluation data. 96% of the children, when they exit our program, are up to date on their well child health exams and immunizations. 95% of the families showed positive parenting and parent-child attachment. 100% of the children had health insurance. 60% of our adolescent mothers have completed and graduated from high school. And only 3% of our mothers enrolled in our program had a subsequent adolescent birth. Our family home visiting services are based on a national model, a best practice, well-researched model that has 15 years of longitudinal study reflecting the long-term benefits of home visiting. The research of Dr. David Olds has shown that public health services have had a major improvement, showing 48% less incidence of child abuse, and mothers show an 83% increase in workforce participation. We've also received a letter of support from the Minnesota Visiting Nurses Association, which is the primary provider of services to Hennepin and Minneapolis. And I'll be glad to answer any questions that you have.
Any questions for the witness member? Okay, thank you. And I also think there's some similar information from the Olmsted County program as well in your packet numbers. Dr. Ephraim and Ms. Brays, if you want to also, if you want to go down together, we can save the transition time. I mean, you can speak later, but start making your way. Thank you. Please identify for yourself for the record and proceed.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman and members of the committee. My name is Dr. Karen Ephraim. I'm a mother of three, a pediatrician and a policy analyst for EdWatch, as well as a board member for the National Physicians Center for Family Resources. I'm here to express our strong opposition to this bill for a number of reasons. First of all, regarding efficacy, there have been three national reviews of home visiting programs regarding child abuse reduction rates, one in 1999 and one in 2004 and another in 2005 that was actually stated in congressional testimony regarding this, and they all admit that home visiting programs do not produce long-term results in child abuse rates, and that is including an evaluation of the old study, the old studies called the Nurse Family Partnership that was mentioned by previous testifiers. Regarding parental rights, evaluation of home visiting programs raised concern about medical record review without consent, consent not potentially being voluntary for participation, such as mothers being recruited during labor, training, variations in the home visitors between anything from high school graduates all the way to public health nurses. Information presented being unscientific or biased, data collection concerns, and families unknowingly giving up their Fourth Amendment rights by allowing people into their home that are, on the one hand, taking the role of being helpers and on the other hand being mandated child abuse reporters. Regarding the bill, I know that it has been amended now to take out the universal aspects of it. but there's still a concern about the definition of at risk expanding significantly in the delete all amendment. There's new language talking about prenatal involvement, also including families at risk of long-term welfare dependency or family instability due to employment barriers and those families with, and then there's a list of 10 different risk factors, including a catch-all, other risk factors as determined by the commissioner. With those kinds of very lax criteria, almost everyone could be considered at risk, even though the focus is theoretically on low-income people. And then the question remains, who is giving consent to these people to decide which families are at risk and to review the data to decide which families are at risk. There's also the issue of comprehensive services. Reviews of these programs have found, even in $1,999, dollars, that comprehensive services can cost up to $47,000 per family and do nothing to improve the cognitive development of the child. All of the old, of the evaluation studies of the old research of the nurse family partnership admit that there is no effect on mental development, on mother-child interaction, on academic performance. So these programs are getting more positive review than the research actually admits. And I want to comment on the brain research piece that was testified to earlier. There is significant scientific controversy about brain research, including by Dr. Nelson from the University of Minnesota, who was also mentioned by a previous testifier, who said it may be useful to question the simplistic view that the brain becomes unbendable and increasingly difficult to modify after the first few years of life. Although clearly much of brain development occurs late in gestation, through the first years of postnatal life, the brain is far from set in its trajectory, even at the end of adolescence. So to say that we need these things for brain development is at best an oversimplification. There are many, many concerns about this bill, given the expansion, the cost, and the concerns about parents' rights and constitutionality. And we would suggest instead that you look at programs that promote marriage and two-parent families and prevention efforts such as voluntary family education and support classes and community respite care centers, as opposed to the more invasive and not proven effective home visiting programs. Thank you.
Questions, members? Representative Brood.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Dr. Ephraim, can you tell me, are you in practice today?
Not right now.
Your pediatrician, is that right? When was the last time you practiced? Can I ask?
Mr. Chairman and Representative Brood, I practiced 10 years ago.
10 years ago, okay. Thank you very much.
Representative Schumper.
Mr. Chairman, Doctor, I'm having a hard time understanding. You're testifying against this bill. Obviously, you think there are some problems with it. Is there nothing in the bill that you agree with?
Doctor?
Mr. Chairman and Representative Schumper, I am very concerned about the inclusion criteria, the visiting. I am concerned about the programs, both the home visiting themselves and the other services that are are suggested through this bill, because there are significant research controversies about mental health screening, psychiatric screening of young children, for instance, the effectiveness of early childhood programs and other things. And I think that for the cost, the effectiveness, and constitutional concerns, I think there are other ways to support families that aren't nearly as intrusive.
Resident Trevor.
Mr. Chairman, Doctor, it sounds to me then like yours is a sort of a broad indictment of most of what people are doing today in government in terms of helping people in early childhood, helping minorities, helping people who don't have much experience in raising children or who haven't had much of a chance to learn that. I mean, it sounds that way. It sounds like that's what you're saying. It's kind of a broad indictment of a lot of things that come in front of this committee and are part of public policy in the state. Would that be a fair way to characterize,
Mr. Chair,
your comments?
Mr. Chairman, Representative Chumper, there are ways to help people that don't involve expansive and intrusive government programs, and instead of creating high-cost, high-intervention programs, we are suggesting instead to support families and to allow parents to raise their children and to get their information not necessarily from one monolithic source, when it is the government's duty not to promote one particular view or philosophy, especially of child rearing.
President Abler.
Well, I just think we're getting close to a line. I think the witness has opinions that may differ from some of the members of the committee, and I don't always agree with her. But I respect where she comes from, and she has the right to her expert opinions based upon her knowledge. And it's just that's all.
Okay. Representative Walker.
I'm sorry, it's not for the testifier. I just want to get on the list for the author. Sorry.
Any further questions, members?
And Mr. Chairman, I have a copy of the congressional testimony that I submitted last fall that contains references to many of the studies that I mentioned, plus more.
Thank you. Ms. Braze.
Thank you.
Oh, one more question, I guess, for the doctor. Have you reviewed the CDC's report and the studies that are cited in there on the effect on child maltreatment?
Mr. Chairman, I haven't seen the CDC report. I have reviewed the congressional testimony and many of the reviews of the Nurse Family Partnership, including the 2004 and 2005 studies.
Okay, thank you. Ms. Braze.
Mr. Chair, members of the committee, thank you very much. My name is Twyla Braze. I'm president of Citizens Council on Healthcare. And this program has been a concern of ours since it was first introduced, I think, in 1999. And at that time, it was also introduced to be universal, as it was this time, but now it has been taken back. I think what I most want to share with you is my concern having to do with the data privacy of families and what families are told and what they know and what actually happens. So essentially what happens in a home visiting program is that someone from the government or someone representing the government comes in and collects data on the family, on the children, on the interactions that happen. And if you heard that one testifier before, I'm sorry, I don't remember her name, but she talked about assessing family health and history, the health history of the mom, the use of medication, the needs for family planning, assessments of the whole family system, safety of the home, environmental assessment, neighborhood safety, and all of that. And one of our concerns is that you have someone coming, and how exactly is the program presented to them? do they understand that the information is going to be collected on them, or do they think that they're just getting a helping hand? Do they know how that anyone got the information that they were going to have a baby in the first place? And do they have a right to say that you can't just take this information and send it out to someone who thinks that you're high risk? That's what this bill says. Someone who's high risk. Well, you might decide that someone is high risk, and I would not decide that they were high risk. But suddenly they are tagged as being high risk. And it becomes part of a government record on the child and the family that this is a high-risk family. And so there's sharing of information that's happening behind the back of the family. And then they're contacted, and how is it presented to them? Is it presented that all this information is going to be acquired on them and collected on them and assessed? And, for instance, at the health department, they do something called the home assessment. And I have this out of the health department's document. They do these things, and I wonder if they tell the parents. They assess emotional and verbal responsivity, avoidance of restriction and punishment, likely corporal punishment is what I'm thinking, safe and organized environment, provision of appropriate play material, involved with the child, opportunities for variety and daily stimulation. And all of these assessments are made on the value system of the person making the assessment. But do the families even know that these assessments are being made on them? Do they know that a record is being created on them? I am guessing that they do not. I'm thinking that they're just coming in and thinking that this person is going to help them, is going to help them with their family. One study that was done in the year 2000, two mothers expressed fear that the visitors coming in could take away their children away if they were not perceived as coping. What is the power that a parent feels, or do they let this happen because they don't feel like they have power? Is it because they're on Medicaid and if they say no, are they afraid that their Medicaid will be lost? I just want to, say, when it comes to this bill, and we don't really have a copy out here of the delete all. But I saw one copy, and what I can remember of it is that prenatal is being added, which means data is shared before the baby's even born, before there's even a birth certificate. And then there's going to be assessment of greatest risk and other risk factors, and someone will make that assessment about them without any of their say-so. And then their data will be shared. And then the third is that interdisciplinary process means that there will be greater data sharing amongst greater organizations. And I don't see anything in here that really requires the parents to be told what's happening, who's got the data, where it's going, and how it will be used, and that it will be permanently created on their family. And so that's, I guess, you know, we have opposed this program because we've never seen anything that was going to give the parents truly informed consent. They would be able to opt out, but first of all, you have to know what's going to happen before you even have an opportunity to opt out. And so the things that I would ask for if this bill goes forward, even though we have not ever been, have ever appreciated the bill, but what I would ask for is full disclosure to the parents prior to disclosing any of their information to anyone who will come out and visit them. Full disclosure of the data collection process, what's being collected, where it will go, and how it will be used. And then third, I think a Tennyson warning is required. They should be told that they don't have to provide the data, what the government will do with the data. And that's all a part of a Tennyson warning about government collection of data.
Ms. Brace, are none of those things done right now?
Mr. Chair, I'm sorry. Not that I know of.
You don't know the opposite, though, either?
What would be the
I'm opposite? Seeing nods back here that stuff is actually done. So I'm just... If you're basing this on factual information you have, that's great. If not, we should make sure that we're basing it on facts. And we do need to move on as well. So,
Mr. Chair, we have tried since this legislation was created to actually require by statute that such things happen. And it's not in statute. It's not required. Whether they do or don't, I don't know, but it's not required.
I appreciate that. Okay. Mr. Pritchard?
Yeah,
Representative Ruth, well, Mr. Pritchard. So, Ms. Brace, there's a question. I'm sorry.
To that point, in the bill on page 3 that we have, and maybe Ms. Brace doesn't have this, it says under Division D, data collected on individuals served by the home visiting programs must remain confidential and must not be disclosed by providers of home visiting services without a specific informed written consent that identifies disclosures to be made. And it would be interesting to me to have some of the community health departments speak. I know there are HIPAA laws, there are provisions in place, so I think it would be important to get what the facts are on this. Data sharing.
Mr. Chair.
Okay. And Ms. Brace, briefly.
Confidential can also require, I mean, I'm not exactly sure the language that you're talking about, that means that only the health department will have it, because we're talking about multidisciplinary, interdisciplinary, which means that it would be able to be shared. In addition to that, most of these home visiting programs have allowed, most of the visiting programs have been part of a larger data system, a national data system called PIMS, P-I-M-S. But I'm not positive, I will say I'm not positive that the health department actually shares data with the CIMS system.
Mr. Pritchard.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. My name is Tom Pritchard, President of Minnesota Family Council.
And I'm sorry, Mr. Pritchard, we are getting close, so if I don't want to, anyway,
I
thank you.
Yeah, I'll be quick. I'll just reiterate some of the points probably already made, but we just have philosophical and practical problems with the program, and we do see it as clearly an expansion, not only financially, but also in who it's serving. It talks about other risk factors. It says give priority. It removes income levels. So we see it as clearly an expansion. But the main problems we see with this approach, and I think we all want to help kids. We want to help parents. It's not like I come up here and I'm against parents or kids. I mean, I have children and I have a wife, and I want the best for them as well. But we just feel that this is not the most effective approach to helping families and children. We see this as that the government has inherent limitations. We see this as potentially creating more dependency on government, promoting. We almost see the home visiting officials as salespeople for government programs, trying to get people more engaged and involved in government programs, which in our view, in some respects, creates greater dependency. We see potential for intrusiveness. A number of concerns were raised there as well as how parents discipline their children, corporal punishment, and things like that. What about officials who disagree with that? Are they going to view that as child abuse, even when it's done in an appropriate manner? And we question whether this is really the most effective approach. Long-term studies were already articulated don't show that this is having the big payoff or benefits that people are saying it does. And what should be done, in our view, I think in this case, parents need to be provided with the printed material and told that these services are available, but we don't believe that the home visiting official should be aggressively pursuing them. We also believe, as was mentioned, that there should be the promotion and encouragement of marriage. That's really the best program for fighting, in our view, fighting poverty and protecting children is a healthy marriage, having a mother and a father in a child's life, and yet we don't see that in these programs. And finally, we believe that the community's resources need to be involved. Churches, private groups, referrals to these groups to really provide what I believe government ultimately can provide, which is the personal love and compassion that people need in these difficult situations. So we believe that the approach should be more of a less bureaucratic, costly, and intrusive approach, and yet we see this moving in the other direction. Thank you, Mr. Chair.
Representative Walker.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. I'll be quick. Oh, yeah. I would have so much to say if we had so much more time. But I just want to thank Representative Lane for bringing this bill forward, regardless of our views
on
this. Just two quick examples of benefits to home visiting. One, if an individual grew up getting a sip of liquor and thinking that was okay, that's not okay. We know better now. That would be considered abuse. That's something that could be stopped and curtailed. Another example that back in the day we thought that giving a child a bottle to prop and filled with juice was okay. We know better health-wise, wellness. And so these are opportunities that we can better educate individuals that may have not had the resources or the new knowledge that we know today. And so again, thank you for the bill.
Okay, members. I think we're all fully informed on the bill. So, and I think it was a helpful discussion to hear everything. So I'm going to renew my motion that House File 595 be recommended to pass as amended, referred to the Finance Committee. All in favor of that motion, say aye.
Aye.
All opposed?
No.
The motion prevails. The bill will move on. Thank you, everybody. We're... Oh, and House File 320 we're going to do on Tuesday. I apologize. Well, he's gone. Thank you.
We're adjourned.